step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is FNX.
Listen to Shoot the Defense. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Welcome to Shoot the Defense on FNX, brought to you by My Sportswear, Youth Energy and Save Association. I'm your host, Stel, and my guest is former British Lions, Manchester United and Blackburn Rovers physio, David Favre. David, brilliant to have you on the show. How are you? And thanks for coming on.
Yeah, no problem. Looking forward to it. It's first time I've done a podcast, so hopefully been an enjoyable experience.
Wow, that's actually quite a humbling thing for me, actually. Your first podcast. Great stuff.
I like it.
Well, David, correct me if I'm wrong, mate, but you played rugby union for a club in Urmson while doing a master's in sports physiotherapy, is that right?
I did. I'm very impressed with your background. Yeah. When I first came over to Manchester, I was playing rugby union. And obviously, at the time, that was important to me, probably more than doing the physio at the time, because obviously I just wanted to try and make a career of playing, but it wasn't like it is now in the present days and age, and people weren't going professional. And then I suddenly realised that I wasn't quite making the progress I should have done, and then ended up chucking myself into my job full time, which is and more, I suppose you could say.
Am I right in thinking playing such a physical sport helped with your studies somewhat?
Yeah, it did do in many ways. In the fact that, I mean, I was lucky; I never got many injuries. But in that scenario, you were coming across things, and you were, I suppose, at that time you were experimental a bit, because obviously you get injured on a Saturday. And you've probably got an injury that nowadays I'd be looking at going, yeah, you're not training for 7 or 8 days, and I'd probably go back and train on Monday and Tuesday. So in that situation, you were testing things out and thinking, well, I've managed to do it myself, so I'm sure the players can do it. So in a way, there's a little bit of realisation as time goes on that when there's a midweek game, there's a player picking up on a Saturday, don't just rule him out because the clinical textbook says this, blah, blah, blah. It depends on the individual's ability to cope with that type of sensation and the strain and what it limits it gives them. So it was very good in that sense. I think having played rugby union and worked in rugby league, it was a massive grounding for football. And I would certainly advise any budding physios to go along a similar line if possible.
So is it true your physio career started at Lancashire Cricket Club with former Man United physio Laurie Brown?
It did. I was working in the NHS at the time, and I got a phone call one afternoon saying, we've heard you've got a physio that's keen on sports injuries, and there weren't many male physios at that time. And they said, was I interested in going down? And hospitals were really good. They gave me, I used to take half a day holiday to go down and work with Laurie at the cricket, which was great. And I can always remember my first patient was, some of the listeners might not remember him, but a guy called Gladstone Small. He was a fast bowler, and the lads stitched me up really, because what they did was they came in for treatment, and apparently Gladstone's only got 6 vertebrae instead of 7, and so he came in with his neck problem, and of course I'm a young, fresh physio trying to look after him, and the lads all started laughing in the doorway thinking, if something's not right here, and it was a bit of a stitch up, but he was playing for Warwickshire at the time.
Brilliant.
But very enjoyable. I mean, Laurie was a lovely guy, you know, and Laurie's obviously got a lot of experience. And it was good for me at that age, you know, I was only 22, 23 at that time, so he was invaluable at that time, just helping me through that first sort of sports-related job.
Yeah, that's great to know, because obviously, you know, he was in the game for a very long time, and to have someone to look up to like that, it's incredible.
Yeah, no, he was excellent, and he was great to go and work with, and, you know, I have a lot of time for Laurie. He was good with me, and he taught me a lot in that 6 months I worked at Lancashire, which was great.
You spent 9 years at 2 rugby league clubs, namely Lee and Wigan. You also won the Great Britain physio job. Now, I hear many First Division physios were very unhappy with your appointment. If true, why do you think this was the case?
Yeah, I think the problem was I was at a club that wasn't fashionable. So I was at a club, I was at Lee Rugby, and at that time, physios were really, the situation was that in the physio world, anybody can call themselves a physio. You don't have to go to medical school, you don't have to get any qualification. And then the other side of the coin is the chartered physios, and I was a chartered physio. I'd gone to uni, done medical school, got my chartered qualification. And Rugby League Club didn't employ a lot of chartered physios, but the Rugby League at the time made a point, look, we're taking a physio away on tour with us, we need somebody who's got insurance, who's got backup for the players. And at that time, I applied for the job thinking, well, I'm at Lee Rugby, I'm not really going to have a chance here. And I was amazed when, like, 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from David Oxley saying we'd like to do the Great Britain-France game and then hopefully do the Papua New Guinea-Australian tour. So I was amazed. I was like, where did this come from? This was, like, from nowhere. And, of course, all the physios here at the bigger clubs, I think we're a bit miffed that happened. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I think a lot of that was because the Rugby League had set a grounding and saying, look, you know, we need a chartered physio. And a lot of the time at the clubs didn't employ people who had insurance and had medical qualifications.
So you mentioned the Lions tour, but you did two Lions tours and one World Sevens.
Yeah.
What would you say is your most memorable moment out of the three?
Most memorable moment. Well, beating the Kiwis in the 1991 was brilliant. So we had a really with a few big names in it at that time. L. Ray Hanley, Martin the Fire had just come back into the team. We'd lost one or two big key players, Sean Edwards, etc. So we weren't really expected to do well, and Malcolm Riley, who was the head coach at the time, was, you know, determined that wasn't going to be the case. And anybody who knows Malcolm, he's a winner, and there was no way we weren't going to win that without 110% effort, and that was brilliant, and I really enjoyed that. And again, the Australian trip was great. We won in Melbourne. Unfortunately, we couldn't win the third test. The Aussies were just that bit too good for us. But again, an amazing experience. You're the only physio working with like 34 guys who were training every day, playing a physical sport like rugby league. And it was just me and a doctor, and that was it. We didn't have the support teams like you see the big premiership clubs have now. There was just two of us look after 34 players, and it was full on. You know, you were doing 14-hour days. If you weren't covering training, you were treating injuries, you were going to the gym with the players. But for 8 weeks, it was tremendous. You know, you were away for that period of time. One of the trips was 12 weeks, and you just got on, and every day it was just full on. But it was so enjoyable. Mm. It was great. And I came back with so much experience. That was the massive thing about it. I learned a lot about rugby and people and so on. And I always remember my mum saying, I've gone away a lad and come back a man, you know, and it's that type of trip. And it was really enjoyable.
Yeah. I mean, it's the biggest physio role in British Rugby League, isn't it? And you left that role to become physio of one of the biggest clubs in the world, namely Manchester United. Now, what were the main differences you noticed initially between the Great Britain and United in terms of dynamics?
Well, I mean, to let you into a secret, I actually wanted to go full-time in rugby league.
Okay.
And that was my aim there. And when the job came over Man U, I went thinking, oh, I'll never get this. And when I got offered the job, I remember speaking to the chairman at Wigan at the time, Jack Robinson, and going, look, I'd really like to go full-time in Wigan. And he basically said to me, he said, we haven't got the facilities to do it, but we'll talk about it in a few weeks. We were playing the Broncos in the World Cup Challenge. And I remember ringing Maurice Lindsay and Malcolm Riley up and so on and speaking to them. And I remember Maurice saying to me, look, so if you're an actor, where would you want to perform in terms of being on the big stage? I said, well, Broadway or something like that. Well, you know, it's easy. Where's the biggest stage? Wigan or Man United? And I went, well, Man United. So why are you thinking about it? And that's what made me go to Man United. Because I was always a rugby person. And when I started the job at United, I remember saying to the gaffer at the time, Fergie, and saying, look, not being funny, but not a football fan, why are you giving me the job? And he said, that's why we're giving you the job, because you're here as a physio, we've heard good things about you. We don't need somebody who's a football fan, we need somebody who's going to work hard and obviously help us in terms of the support staff for the medical team, and that's how it ended up going with Mr. Iron at United. It was quite remarkable, really.
Well, mate, we've seen how money has impacted the game, and you worked at United during not only their most successful era, but also a period where they had a major influence in the financial evolution of the Premier League. I mean, you look at players now, and they're seen as assets, and you actually took care of the biggest cash cow in football history, namely David Beckham. Can you describe the levels of expectation and pressure you were under?
You know what? I never felt any pressure. It was the manager never put me under any pressure. Look after the players, never put us under any pressure. I know it sounds that people will find that hard to believe, but even for every manager, I've never ever been put under any pressure about having a player sit. Or, you know, I've always been a guy who's down to earth and honest. And I think sometimes that's the way you've got to be. You can't faff around, and you've got to be honest with the players and so on. And hopefully that's what's got me through in my career to this point. And the fact that I never felt pressure in terms of having to have players fit. If they were fit, they were fit. And if they weren't, they weren't. And it was my job to make sure that I could give the manager, you know, the players that were relevant. Obviously, nowadays, with the finances that are involved and so on, I mean, that's a massive thing that people don't recognise. You know, you can work at a club, and if you can keep more and more players fit, then the club don't need to have as many players in that squad. And that's always been my ethos in terms of, look, the bigger problems we want to produce is give the manager a headache. He's got too many players fit. And that often is the situation where sometimes if you've got too many fit players, the manager's got a bigger problem. If the team doesn't pick itself, he's got to make decisions. And it's a problem I like to give him, really, because that's what he's paid for, and I'm paid to keep players fit, and that's how you sort of work the thing together. So, yeah, it's strange. I never, ever felt it. I never felt under pressure. You know, I felt more pressure having to pay the mortgage than looking after the players. It wasn't a problem.
I was speaking to a former Arsenal player, Lee Harper, some time ago. It was around about the time when there was that incident between Jose Mourinho and the female physio at Chelsea.
Yes.
And he was saying to me, you know, when he was playing at Arsenal, Gary Lewin was, even though he was his physio, he was more like an agony uncle at the same time as well. You know, players are on the physio's bench, you know, receiving treatment, they've got a lot of problems, you know, they don't know whether they're going to get back into the team, they don't know if they're going to recover fully. What relationship did you have with the players? Was it a similar sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, Gary's obviously well respected, and Gary's excellent in terms of doing that the way he does that ability. And I think as a physio, your job is to sit in the middle. You have to sit between the players and the manager, and you don't have to be friendly with either particular departments, but it's important that you're there for both parties, and you create a bridge. And what you mustn't do is get too close to the players, because then obviously it creates an issue with the manager. You don't want to be too close to the manager, because the players then think you're a snitch and things get back. So you have to sit in that middle point. And again, with experience, you have to know that, you know, what information you can pass to both parties. It's important that you recognise that there's a confidentiality situation in both areas. If a player has an issue that the manager's asking you about, look, I can't tell you that because the player, it's private between me and the player. And in many scenarios, people don't realise that that isn't an official scenario. When it, you know, if it went to a court of law, then you have to hold that confidentiality rule for both parties. So even if you're employed by a club, you've got no permission. You don't have to give out players' medical information without their permission. Otherwise, the player and the agent could actually do something about it legally in terms of what you're saying. So it's a really hard line to keep. And that's important that you sit in that middle gap and you sit and you say, look, I'm here for you. I'm not your mate. I'm not going out socialising with you, but I'm here. The phone's on. You can always ring us. And that's where people like Gary have done such a good job, because Gary's done that many times with England and Arsenal. And it's important that you are there for the lads, and you can try and give them some help, some experience that you've perhaps had in your life, because obviously usually you're a little bit older than the lads, and try and help them in that state. So you're really not just treating the injury, you're treating the injury and the player themselves. And obviously with the younger players now, with the pressures they're under from the financial and sponsors and teams and so on, it's important that you try and be there for them, to try and give them a sounding block where you can help them in one way or the other. And often if you do that, it actually helps the injury get better quicker, because you're taking some of the pressure that they're creating on themselves in terms of what's expected of them.
Brilliant. Fantastic. So, David, as a Man United fan, I have an innumerable amount of questions relating to your time at the club. I'll keep it down to two.
That's fine.
You've seen so many incidents, so much success over the 5 years you were there. What was the atmosphere like in the dressing room? Because I get the impression that there was somewhat of a siege mentality, especially during Cantona's suspension and Beckham's return from the 98 World Cup.
Yeah, I think there was definitely that. I mean, the gaffer was always was against them, and I think the attitude in terms of, you know, this is Man United and this is what we do, and, you know, again, you don't realise the demands that are on the club and the players. Wherever we went, there was pressures pre-season, in-season, out-of-season, you know, everything you did was under the microscope. For those scenarios that you had to know how to deal with it and how to cope with it, and obviously players who did so well were able to cope with that, and the gaffer was good at bringing things down to earth and saying, you know, keeping Man United not as the big multi-story empire that you see now, but as a club that basically had a very sound base and was there for the fans and everything that went with it. So, yeah, there was definitely, and I think coming up to that treble season, I think one big turning point in that year was when we won the semi-final against Arsenal with 10 men and Giggs' goal. And I think everybody then suddenly believed that they could win the treble because there was that, if we can beat Arsenal with 10 men, then we can beat anybody. And that's how the lads' attitude goes. And I can always remember Yorkie counting the games down. Lads, 22 more wins and we win the treble, and 21 and 20, and suddenly you get down to single figures, and then you're down to 3 and 2 and 1, and you just can't believe it actually happened. So that stood the lads in great stead, like a couple of years later after the Cantona and the Beckham thing. You know, I think that was one of the big things that got them to where they were at that time.
Well, that's a great segue into my next question. How can you sum up 98-99?
Difficult. I mean, it's probably not long enough for this podcast. I mean, I think in that scenario, the lads' attitudes were obviously unbelievable in terms of what they did. Obviously, I think the one area where you could have thought it might go wrong was when Kiddo left, because Kiddo was very close with the players, and the players were very close with him. And Steve came in and did a great job in terms of not trying to be a Kiddo, of just being a Stephen Clown, and the gaffer was good at moulding that in. And I think that previous story about Yorkie counting them down and the lads realising what they were on the verge of, I think to get to that point, as I say, the Arsenal game was the turning one. To win with 10 men and for Giggs' goal, and then we saw, if we can do that against Arsenal, we can beat anybody. And I can remember then the game just getting ticked off, and even in the final itself, you sat there and you're thinking, no, we're not going to win this, we're one down, it's 8 to 9 minutes, and then lo and behold, 5 minutes later, it's all changed again.
I can't even begin to imagine what that bench was like, or even the dressing room at the end of the game. I'm not going to answer. We'll probably leave that for another time, actually. Well, David, the treble season was your final year at United. A move to Blackburn followed, where you now head their sports medicine department. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I've actually just left in January.
Okay.
No, that's fine. I gave my notice in a year ago. I decided when I was 55 I wanted to go freelance.
Right.
And now I'm working for 4, 5, 6 clubs, working for the FA, working for the Rugby League, doing podcasts, doing webinars, doing loads of little different things, working for a team, Morten Pedersen's team, going over there to Norway, helping them for a week here and there.
Oh, brilliant.
So loads of different stuff, so it's good.
I'm not saying that you enjoy it more than what you did before, but does this give you more of a freedom to do whatever you want?
It does now, but I think I'm lucky to have the freedom because of the years I've been in the game and met a lot of people. And what I did was I did a year's notice, and so when people were finding out that I was sort of available, would you fancy coming over here and working here for so long? And somebody offered me a job for a year, and I went, no, I don't want to do a year. I said, I'll do a month, I'll do 2 months, but I want to be able to do all these different things, I want to travel. So it's been good that way, but I wouldn't swap anything I've done. But now you get to the age I'm at now, I wanted to be able to do this in the last sort of like 10, 15 years of my career, where I can travel and do things at other clubs and other continents and countries, which sometimes you can't do when you're working in football. You've got to be there 11 and a half months of the year and you're tired of it. Certainly when I was at United, not so much at Blackburn, because Blackburn, they were very good in like helping it promote Blackburn as a club. If I got asked to go and lecture and so on, they saw that as a flagship to promote Blackburn as a club itself, rather than having the promotion that Man United does off its own back. So it worked quite well when I moved to Blackburn to be able to do that side of my career. So now I'm doing it all the time, it's even better.
David, I don't know if you read the article about neuropathologist Dr. Anne McKee's study, where she examined the brains of 202 deceased American footballers. I think 111 of them played in the NFL, but all but one had a CTE. I know the study has its limitations, but what's your take on it?
I think there's obviously more research to be done. I think there's obviously it's something we need to be aware of in football. Obviously, with the amount of money that's been bandied around in the American football side of things, and obviously with the Will Smith film and everything else that's gone with it, I think it's important that the FA and the clubs themselves do everything they can. I think there are things that we can still do to improve that. Certainly with the money that's in the game, there's no reason why, you know, every team in the Premiership and certainly Championship with the PFA support, everything should be there to try and investigate it, and secondly, try and prevent something happening that obviously people couldn't recognise several years ago. So, is there a higher incidence? There are suggestions. And I think while the research suggests something, then it has to be looked into a bit more. But I think the game has to make sure it's got its own house in order, to make sure that everything's done to prevent that tragedy happening. And if things can be done to put into place, start from creating that problem, then so it should be. But I think until we get some definite research, then obviously it's going to be more of a recommendation than an actual forced rule. But I think it's important that they do have those steps ready to cover themselves in case that it obviously then turns out to be a link between the two.
So would you say this also applies to the number of footballers who have actually suffered cardiac arrests and died while playing? Because I think the figure currently stands at 64 since 2010. And you've got the high-profile names like Cheick Tiote was the last one who this happened to. And then I think Phil O'Donnell and maybe Antonio Pareto of Sevilla back in 2007 were the last high-profile ones. But is it probably now and impossible to find a reason why there's been such an increase? Do you think clubs are doing enough to protect players?
The hardest thing, and I do quite a bit of work for the FA and so on nowadays, it's something that's certainly in the forefront of what they're doing in terms of their teaching, in terms of treating the condition once it's happened and so on. I think at the moment, because every sport has its own particular guidelines, nobody's actually come to a concrete rule as what should be done in terms of screening. You know, things like horse racing and rugby union and so on have all got different remits, as has boxing to football, and nobody's come up with a conclusive this is what we should do for every sport. And while that's happening, it's important to have your own house in order. I know from my experience at Blackburn, our doctor and myself spoke to our cardiologist, and our line was to do the test that the FA recommend and then to do it 2 years afterwards. And we just thought politically it was important to do that to try and make sure that it doesn't happen. Now, there's no stipulation. You could screen every year and still have a cardiac arrest on the pitch. You know, that can happen. You know, if somebody takes a direct blow on the heart for a fraction of a second, that can give you what's called a commotio cordis, which is an instant cardiac arrest from that scenario. So you can never predict for that. Obviously, the ones that appear to be in the media at the moment have got some sort of genetic base. And again, when you're screening and when you're doing it, there are players that will flag up as high-risk players. And in that scenario, that's the important thing. Again, not knowing the cases of all the players you mentioned previously, it's difficult to comment as to what screening remits they'd had done and whether anything came up. It's impossible to do so. But I think from our own scenario, and from my own experience of it, that any players where we had cardiac issues, then I certainly feel as though the process that we followed from a screening point of view and what we did afterwards in terms of further screening and surgery in occasional cases obviously prevented us from having a problem. But again, some of that's luck and having that scenario. You know, Fabrice had had so many screens done when he was with the FA, it can still slip through and that can still create a problem. So there are many factors that come into it rather than just saying, well, if we do an echo and an ECG, then every player will be fine. It doesn't follow at all, I'm afraid, which it would be nice if it did, but those are the basic guidelines that we have to do at least.
Absolutely. Well, David, I've got a few more questions, but they're quick listener questions. What does a medical involve when a player is being transferred?
Oof, that could be a podcast in its own right. really, your job on a medical, and this is the way I always translate it, if you were buying a car, you would get the AA to inspect it. If you were buying a house, you'd get a surveyor to come and inspect it. And really, when you're doing a medical, it's a similar thing. You're employed by a club. You know, I was employed by Blackburn. I've done medicals for other clubs in the last few months. And you're employed by, and your job is to try and find a fault with that, if there is one. And if you can find a fault, it then gives them a negotiating tool to try and reduce the price of the player or the demands of the player and so on. So my attitude is, look, I work for Blackburn Rovers. Our job, we want this player. We want to get him, in a good fit state. We know what he's like. And also, the financial people want to get it at the best price they can for Blackburn. And because Blackburn paid my wages. That was part of my job. It was a part of my job I really, really enjoyed, because it was amazing how, when we were doing medicals, things we'd find and things we'd pick up and go, we can use that as a bartering tool to try and reduce the transfer fee, reduce the player's demand. We're still wanting, but we can offer you this and not this because we think this. And again, in many scenarios, we had players who'd had poor playing records before they came to the club. I can think of someone like Rocky Santa Cruz. Rocky Harder has played for Bayern Munich. Played a full season at Blackburn and then went to City. And, you know, obviously came in on a low price and then was sold for 20 million to City. And that was part of our job, was to, you know, we're Blackburns and not a Man United or a City at the present. Our job was to get players in, get them into better players, and then sell them on and make money for the club. And that was one of the big things that was enjoyable about the job, is that you were there to try and ensure that the finances were kept balanced by getting players that nobody else wanted or felt they couldn't. And then we would try and not rebuild them. We would try and ensure that we could do everything possible to keep their injury record low, and then hopefully they'll do well for the club, and then hopefully we might sell them on us at a later date if we weren't going to keep them.
In the back of my mind, I was kind of hoping you were going to say, we make them do 5K on an exercise bike with wires hanging out.
we do a part of the physical thing, and certainly if you sign in a player in January, that's a big thing. If you sign in a player this time of the year, obviously, then you've got time to get them fit, but if you're making a couple of signings in January, you don't want to be signing a player that needs 2 months to get fit, because before you know it, it's the end of March, and then there's 8 games in the season to go, and they're not going to influence the season. So what you said there, the physical parameter is massively important in January, more so than it is this time of the year, because you need them up and running. You need them into your team, certainly, like obviously at the level that Blackburn were involved.
Brilliant. What sports nutrition advice do you have for sportsmen and women to avoid injuries?
Sports nutrition advice, first and foremost, is obviously speak to the people who've got far more knowledge than I have. I mean, there are so many good dietitians and nutritionists about that got knowledge. Nutrition is very similar to like a lot of things. It comes in fashion, and things will come around, and next year it'll be this, and next year it'll be that. And then it'll come around again. I've seen this happen in physio, and it happens in nutrition massively. My brother's a dietitian, so I hear all these things from him. And I think one of the big things, obviously, in terms of players now, players are far more aware of what's available. Their knowledge now to say, I can remember when I worked for Man United, the magazine would do a programme, what's in such and such a player's fridge? And some of the players' fridges were like, you can imagine, just not there at all in terms of nutrition. You know, it was full of Coke, it was full of chocolate, it was full of this. And if you did it nowadays, I'll tell you now, it'd be so much better than what it was then. But then their argument would be, well, hang on a minute, we won the treble with that. And the players now that you're looking at haven't won it. So that's how players think. If I can win the treble on chocolate and Diet Coke, then that's fine. So I think in that thing, I think it's important to get a balance. That's the big thing. I'm not so sure about supplementation being important. If you have a proper diet, then there's enough nutrients in what you eat if you're eating enough fresh food and so on. This supplementation thing, that really does amaze me that people take so much stuff, because you don't really need it if you eat your proper food in the first place. So that's what I've been taught by many dietitians I've worked with, the late Nick Broad, Trevor Lee, etc. So their knowledge is far better, and I've learned so much from them. I just keep learning off them. So it's one of those things where I think there's enough food available to us now that there's no excuse for not eating properly.
Absolutely. And what's the most common injury you've seen?
The most common injury that I've seen? Again, that tends to come in fashion. I mean, again, the most common one, probably over time, is hamstring, I would say. And I think that's probably every player's bane and every player's nightmares, to get repeated hamstring problems. And again, it's a multifactorial thing. There are many reasons why it can happen. It can be due to fatigue, it can be due to lack of flexibility, it can be due to lack of strength, it can be due to poor management away from the club, and there's all sorts of factors that can relate to it. And that's probably the one that I think it'll always be there for you. And again, there are many factors you can do to try and reduce the volume of injuries, certainly in that area. And again, if the medical team's spot on and they do enough screening and they've got enough baseline data, then you can minimise that to as much as possible. But again, looking on the internet today, there's two or three players I've noticed who are going to be missing 6 to 8 weeks of the season, and the EFL's kicking off on Saturday, and it's going to be September and they're going to miss the rest of the pre-season, and then they're going to be playing catch-up, and it's a nightmare time for them to get those injuries, and that's what, you know, you're hoping they're not going to get. But it keeps coming around, and it keeps physios in jobs, and that's unfortunately the sad way of looking at things.
Fantastic. Well, David, thank you ever so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. I know you're a really, really busy guy, so yeah, I said I really appreciate it. Before I let you go, have you got any ways our listeners can get in touch with you? I believe you do these webinars every now and again. Can they get in touch with you that way?
Yeah, I mean, I do some webinars for other company in terms of that. I mean, I think I'm on LinkedIn, and if anybody's got anything in terms of that, then obviously they can get hold of me through LinkedIn. I'm not one for Facebook and things like that. I've not quite developed to that level. It's important that you keep a little bit of professionalism and so on, so that's the only way I go through. So that anything like that, anything that anybody pops up with in that, you'll find me on there, and it's easy to get hold of me that way.
And if anything, they can buy the Collison Sports Injury and Repair book, right?
I don't know if it's still available. I thought it'd be sold out by now.
Fantastic. David, thank you ever so much for your time. Really appreciate it, mate.
Thanks a lot. No, I really enjoyed it.
It'd be great to have you back on the show again. You've got some fantastic knowledge and stories.
No, anytime you need a filler, then you're more than welcome.
Thank you very much, David. Really appreciate your time, mate. All the best.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for asking that. Thanks, Del.
Anytime.
Take care.
See ya.
Cheers. No, bye-bye.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.